Hello, I'll be talking about opportunistic infections after transplant and a diagnostic approach to patients who present with possible infection. One of the most common consults you might see from an infectious disease point of view is a transplant patient with fever. And let's say you're called about such a patient. The four sort of things that you immediately need to think about are here. So the first you have to ask yourself is, well, what's the type of transplant? And the reason that's important is different transplant patients have risks for different types of infection. So these include technical aspects of the transplant procedure, as well as other aspects related to the degree of immunosuppression those patients on. So for example, a kidney transplant patient would commonly get a urinary tract infection, a liver transplant patient might get cholangitis, a lung transplant patient, typically the most common infection is pneumonia. The next thing you need to ask yourself is time post-transplantation, because there is a very clear timeline in the way that transplant patients get infection. The third question is a level of immunosuppression. The greater the level of immunosuppression, and that includes what the patient is currently on, but what they've gotten, especially in the recent 6 months, greatly influences the type of infections they get. And I'll talk more about these three in more detail. Finally, also the risk of exposure and the types of exposures are very important. So typically a transplant patient who is on minimal immunosuppression, for example, should not get an opportunistic infection unless they've had some type of unusual exposure. So exposure to a respiratory virus pathogen, exposure to a gastrointestinal pathogen, exposure to tuberculosis, or exposure to animals carrying pathogens, for example. So I'm going to briefly talk a bit about these in some more detail. So the type of transplant is very important because technical aspects related to transplantation predominate in terms of infections, especially in the early few weeks after transplantation. So for example, if you have a liver transplant patient, this is a diagram of the liver, you have vascular anastomosis, including the arterial hepatic artery anastomosis and the IVC anastomosis above and below the liver. And then you have a bile duct anastomosis, which can be duct to duct or duct to bowel. And then you have a portal vein anastomosis. And if you imagine the technical complications that can occur relate to any of these anastomosis, and depending on the area that's affected, the type of infection will be different. So for example, in the bile duct, you can either get an anastomotic stricture, which can lead to cholangitis, or you can get a bile leak, which can lead to a bileoma, which subsequently becomes infected. And similarly, if you have a hepatic artery thrombosis, that can lead to ischemic areas within the liver and typically leads to abscess development within the liver. The other important thing is time post-transplant. And very typically, there's a timeline that is quoted for infectious diseases after transplantation. It divides patients into 0 to 1 month, 1 to 6 months, and greater than 6 months. And the types of infections they get are very different between these time periods. So during the 0 to 1 month period, they often get these problems related to technical issues that I described. And this is specific to each organ. They can also get the typical post-operative infections. So these include things like wound infection, urinary tract infection, post-op pneumonia. And these are more common in transplants that are technically more complex. So for example, these complications occur at a higher rate after liver or lung transplantation versus kidney transplantation. The third infection you can see in the first month post-transplant is infections related to the donor. So for example, if a donor has bacteremia, they can transmit that to the recipient. If a donor has pneumonia, that can be transmitted in the case of lung transplantation. The other sometimes unusual infections you see is viral infections in the donor, such as West Nile virus or other unusual infections that can be transmitted to the recipients. Typically, during the first month, we don't see opportunistic infections. There are some exceptions to that. You may see herpes simplex reactivation. You may see an opportunistic infection that is just reactivated in the recipient prior to transplantation that then takes off in the immediate post-transplant period. But typically, most opportunistic infections are seen during the 1 to 6 month period, where many of the patients have maximal intensity immunosuppression. And these may include, in the absence of any prophylaxis, infections such as CMV and other herpes viruses, including EBV reactivation. You will initially start seeing BK virus reactivation here. You will see other opportunistic infections based on either current epidemiological exposures or past epidemiologic exposures. So you may see TB reactivation, nocardia, respiratory viruses, and numerous other opportunistic infections. Then once they're past this period, and in the greater than 6 month period, typically they'll either be on lower levels of immunosuppression or high levels of immunosuppression. And this relates to the type of transplant, the graft function, and whether they've had problems with acute rejection or not. These patients who are on lower immunosuppression generally do not get many opportunistic infections unless they've had some type of unique exposure in the community. These patients, however, continue to behave like the 1 to 6 month post-transplant period, and they continue to be at high risk for opportunistic infections. Now, some of these are modified by the types of prophylaxis that we give patients. So, for example, currently we will use CMV prophylaxis in either all high-risk patients or the majority of high-risk patients. So, for example, if we give valganciclovir for 6 months to a patient, what that does is it pushes the period of CMV beyond 6 months to the period 6 to 9 months post-transplant. Similarly, if we typically use PCP prophylaxis with trimethoprim sulfa for the first 6 months or the first year, we will not usually see PCP in the first year. We will not usually see nocardia infection in the first year, but you may see it after that on occasion. Now I'm going to talk briefly about the type of immunosuppression and how it influences infections post-transplant. So typically what we say is that the higher the immunosuppression, the greater the risk of infection. And the issues with this are, one is it's often hard to gauge how immunosuppressed a patient actually is. We don't have a good, reliable measurement to say this patient is very immunosuppressed versus this patient is only moderately immunosuppressed. The other issue is that certain immunosuppressants influence infection in different ways. So, for example, thymoglobulin, or ATG, has broadly immunosuppressive effects, increases the risk of herpes virus infections, PTLD, and a number of opportunistic infections. Other immunosuppression agents are more selective. So, for example, sirolimus is thought to be a potent immunosuppression, but it also appears to inhibit certain pathways in viral replication and has been associated with a lower incidence of CMV compared to other regimens, and perhaps a decrease in BK virus, although that has not been conclusively proven. And then there are other immunosuppression agents that affect the way patients might get infection. Eculizumab, for example, increases the risk of meningococcal disease. Belatacept, for example, has been associated with a higher risk of CNS PTLD, specifically in patients who are EBV D plus R minus. I'm going to close by, in the last few minutes, just summarizing the common prophylaxis strategies that are used in transplant patients. CMV is the most common agent we use prophylaxis or preemptive therapy for. Most patients are on some strategy to prevent CMV. And prophylaxis is commonly given for a period of 3 to 6 months or longer in some populations. PCP or PJP is commonly prophylaxed again, and typically this is trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole given for at least 6 months, but often out to a year, and in some patients lifelong, especially after lung transplantation. There are different strategies for EBV, and this typically includes monitoring viral loads and adjusting immunosuppression based on viral load elevation. There are strategies to prevent BK virus, and this typically includes, again, monitoring plasma viral loads and adjusting immunosuppression in patients with elevated viral loads in order to prevent BK nephropathy. So I will close there.